Good morning, everyone. The Ways and Means meeting will come to order. Clerk will note the roll. There is a quorum. We have the minutes of the March 24th meeting before us. Would someone like to move the minutes?
I will move the minutes.
Representative Dean moves the minutes. Are there any corrections, additions, changes to the minutes? Seeing none. All in favor of the minutes, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Members, we have five bills before us today, but before I get on to those, and the first bill will be Representative Sanders, if he is here. Before I get on to that, members, just a couple of scheduling notes. We do have a meeting scheduled for Monday, 10:15, our normal time. There are a few bills that have been posted for that day. We're also going to be making some changes to the budget resolution. I've talked to Representative Carlson about those. We'll be posting those that we have in an amendment this afternoon. I've talked to some of the other Republican members about that. The first bill I am aware of that we'll be taking up as an omnibus bill in this committee will be the transportation bill on Thursday. I don't have a time yet on Thursday for our meeting, but I'm expecting it starting Thursday, and then we'd also be meeting next Friday, a week from today. We will start the long march of omnibus bills through the Committee on Ways and Means. I don't have a full schedule with me as to the week beyond that, and I guess I'll update people as I know more, but you should plan on being here next Friday for a meeting of some kind on some omnibus bills, and plan that we'll be taking up the transportation bill at a time to be determined this coming Thursday.
Okay.
There may be other meetings scheduled. Obviously, we're getting to the point in the year where there's going to be a lot of action in the committee. Having said that, I guess, are there any questions anyone wants to ask on that before we get to the other bills? Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, that's helpful tentatively, but a broader question then, as you get the schedule in place, if you could share that with the minority, that would be appreciated. The other question I have is, this takes some coordination with the Senate, you know, in terms of which House files we would take up first, and then they're doing Senate files, so there's some coordination between the two bodies on the timing issue, and so I think it would be helpful to know what road we're on. The only one that's really a given is the tax bill, you know, has to originate in the House. Mm-hmm. But the rest mm-hmm. of them are negotiated in terms of whether we take up a given House file first and they take up a Senate file, and that's all negotiated between the two bodies. So I would hope that that's going on, but if you could share the schedule with us, that would be helpful.
Okay, thank you, Representative Carlson. I guess I believe leadership is having those discussions with the Senate, but I don't really know anything more about that at this point in terms of which bills they think are going to be House or Senate files.
But that, Mr. Chairman, my point is that would determine, I would assume, the order that you would want to take them up in committee in preparation for floor action. And it would help us, you know, without knowing what's happening, whether we have amendments or not on the different bills, but the longer the lead time perhaps helps the minority and others. You may have some on your side of the aisle that may have some amendments as well.
Sure, yeah. Representative Carlson, I certainly want to, you know, keep you informed so that you can prepare amendments. I mean, I think, you know, as you see bills coming earlier, obviously, for the most part, if they're coming out of a omnibus committee earlier, they're probably going to be getting here earlier than later, you know, I should be able to tell you more, you know, perhaps on Monday on where we'll be this coming Friday for what bills are that day, but you know, people, I think, can plan on the transportation bill, I believe, on Thursday for now, and otherwise I'll keep people posted as we have more information.
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman, I'm sure everybody here knows, but the deadline is 2 weeks from today, so the clock is running.
Thank you, Representative Carlson. Any other questions? Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, I just didn't catch what we're having on Monday.
Oh, on Monday there will be three bills, and I guess, Mr. Stone, do you have those bills off the top of your head? I know that I believe I think they were bills by and large that were called back to Ways and Means yesterday. I know that Representative Hortman has a bill dealing with LLCs. Representative Mack has a bill that there's a new fiscal note on that, oh, is some sort of a licensing bill.
There's individual bills.
And Representative Dabney has a bill that we were originally going to schedule today, but then he wasn't available.
Okay.
And then we're also going to be making some changes to the budget resolution, as I mentioned earlier.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Carlson, you said you wanted more direction on what road we take. I take 35E north.
Very good. I take 94 east.
All right. Anyone else? If not...
Transportation Committee.
If not, Representative Sanders, welcome to the Committee on Ways and Means. The Chair will move that House File 177 be referred to the General Register. Representative Sanders, can you present your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. House File 177 is a bill that was heard in Commerce and sent to the General Register. This bill deals with the ability for self-storage facilities to sell insurance for contents of value that are placed in the self-storage facility, largely for those that may not have homeowners insurance, and it allows those self-storage facilities to sell that insurance. A lot of insurance agencies are extremely small policies, very small premiums, and a lot of insurance agents themselves are not interested in even writing this sort of business. So this would allow those folks that really don't have access to insure their valuables, their property that they're placing in a self-storage facility, to earn that or to be able to purchase insurance for those items while they're in that self-storage facility. While we were on the General Register, the Commerce Department put a fiscal note on here. It's target busting fiscal note here of $3,000 a year. So we gladly came before you today and would appreciate your consideration.
And this is probably on the edge of negligible, but since you're here anyway, we thought we would take your bill up. Are there any questions for Representative Sanders? Representative Carlson.
Well, view, Mr. Chair, being that you raised the question of negligible, what are we defining it as this year?
Well, right now I would say that 3,000 and 3,000 is just above the negligible level.
Yeah, I think we used 3,000, if I recall, last year. So,
all right,
very convenient.
Being consistent then, I guess. Thank you. That was more for the author to understand why he's here.
All right. I know that Commerce is here. If there's any questions, is there anyone else from the audience that wanted to testify on the bill? Anyone have any questions for Representative Sanders? Seeing none. I should direct your attention to a letter from Minn Minnesota Legal Aid that was passed out on this bill, dealing more with some of the policy issues.
Mr. Chair, I know
Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know that the advocates have been working with Mr. Elwood and Legal Aid. You know, I've had several conversations with him as well. We may be close to being able to accommodate him on a couple of things, but we're continuing to work on that. But if not, we feel that the bill is in great shape and would appreciate it going back to the General Register.
All right. Seeing no further discussion, the Chair will renew his motion that House File 177 be referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. House File 177 is referred to the General Register.
Thank Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Dill.
Mr. Chair.
Representative McNamara.
Could I move House File 1429 to be passed on to the General Register?
Representative McNamara moves that House File 1429 be referred to the General Register. The Chair recognizes Representative Dill, the Chairs of the Land Subcommittee. Chair Dill, welcome to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you very much, Chair Knobloch. And I discussed with the committee administrator earlier a reshuffling of words in an amendment that I believe he's going to pass out. Okay. I know there's a 24-hour rule. I can do this on the House floor if it so pleases the chair. If the amendment came to me as a amendment that came from the count from the Minnesota Association of Counties that just reshuffled the words under agricultural products
Excuse me, Representative Dill. You're talking about House File 815?
I got the wrong bill.
Okay.
Two laying in front of me. All right, so okay. Back to the lands bill. I'm sorry, I didn't catch Representative McNamara's move.
Okay, and Chairman Dill, I do believe you have an amendment, though, the 0415 amendment. Is that correct?
That's correct.
All right. Representative Hackbarth, would you like to move the amendment? Was this something that you had?
I'll move the amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Representative Hackbarth moves the 0415 amendment. And Representative Dill, would you like to explain the amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, if you on page 8, you'll see this is an amendment that regards a piece of land that is ultimately going to be ending up in private ownership. The language was brought to me by Hennepin County to clarify the intent of the bill that was in the Senate file that was in this bill and contained in this bill, of which there are 17 bills within this House File 1429. And I've checked with Ms. Lewis, Ms. Lewis is the expert from DNR that goes over every single bill to assure that any of these bills that are along public waters that meets the requirements of the state and the public and the folks that are interested in it. And she has indicated to me that it's fine with the amendment. We have Mr. Strand here from Hennepin County if you would like any additional information on the amendment. It's a relatively simple amendment, and it just clarifies the intent.
Okay, members, I wanted to just take up this fairly small amendment before we got on to the main bill. Is there anyone that has any questions about the 0415 amendment? Seeing none, all in favor of the 0415 amendment, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. All right, Chairman Dill, can you explain House File 1429?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, members. The bill has a litany of bills from both sides of the aisle. House File 138, Representative Sundin, 214 is Purcell, 295 is Sundin, 447 is Lewick, 527 is Dill, 547, Representative Pawlowski, 816 is my bill, 1082 is Schoen, 1309 regarding Martin County is Gunther, 1650 is Lake County, that's my bill. 1666 is Simonson, 1773 is my bill, 1840 is Wills, 2027 is Anderson, 2056 is Representative Green, and 2069 is Lucero. Those are all included in the bill, Mr. Chairman. That is normal that we have a lands bill where we do different things. Many of these bills are about public waters, which requires approval by here in the legislature. There's a fiscal note on the bill, Mr. Chairman, if I could discuss the fiscal note specifically. The fiscal note on House File 1429, version 2E shows a $212,000 positive income to the land acquisition account that's held by the DNR. And that originates from three bills that are in one. The first bill is in Section 5, and that's a two pieces of property that one will be traded for the other and ends up with $1,000 on Leech Lake. A private owner owns one, the state owns one. It's the advantage for both the state and the private owner to swap. And as I understand, and Ms. Lewis is here, and she can answer any real technical questions about that particular bill, and that it ends up with a positive amount of $1,000, rather a very small amount. If you have any questions of Ms. Lewis, I'd invite those.
Members of the committee, any questions for either Ms. Lewis or Representative Dill?
Okay, Mr. Chairman, if I can continue then in Section 17, that's a much larger amount. This is a piece of property up in St. Louis County. It's the St. Croix Boys Camp, and the DNR has had that for sale for quite some time. And the asking price was $296,000, but there's been no takers. And so the object is to get it so that it is properly, that it is sold and gets back on the tax rolls. And the anticipated revenue on that is $210,000 currently. And so that's the vast majority and bulk of the fiscal note that's before you. And again, if any questions technically regarding this particular land parcel, I would ask you to direct those to Ms. Lewis.
Does anyone have any questions for Ms. Lewis? Ms. Lewis, looks like you're going to get off easy today.
And Mr. Chairman, the last part of the bill, the last part of the fiscal note is regarding Section 23, and again, a very small $1,000 amount positive revenue on the Long Prairie River. And again, this is the same kind of situation where we're just trying to dispose of the property, get some value into the land acquisition account, and make sure that it's done properly. So again, any technical information would be gotten from Ms. Lewis.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Lewis, since I'm new to the Ways and Means Committee and I've never sat on the committee that puts together a lands bill, and maybe everyone else understands this, but I don't, I'd like to ask you, when we're authorizing the sale of land at less than market value, that seems a little strange to me, because if you can't sell it at a certain value, then kind of by definition, that's not really the market value, right? So, I mean, how is this market value determined that we need to sell the land at a certain value, and that when it doesn't sell, that we need statutory authorization to sell it at a lesser value, which would seem to me, and probably to the layperson, would seem like, well, if that's what a willing buyer will pay, then that is the market value. Can you kind of explain that?
Ms. Lewis.
Mr. Chair, members, Kathy Lewis, Lands and Minerals, DNR. What we do with our land sale process is we conduct an appraisal, and for the St. Boys camp, it's actually been offered many times. We've actually reappraised the property, so the price has come down from $500,000 down to $296,000. So from the appraisal side, the appraisal identifies it as currently worth that much. The reality is we could go back to the appraiser and say, give me a liquidation value and tell me what that number would be. Or we said, because this has been a high-profile property for looking at in the community, we felt it would be better in this case to come to the legislature and say, can we offer it for less than appraised value? The property has buildings on it. To demo the buildings would cost several hundred thousand dollars. And they're also a liability to have vacant buildings on the state land in a remote area. So we would like to dispose of the property and recover it, but we feel that the most efficient way is to be very public in how we're offering it for less than what the licensed appraiser says it's worth.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's helpful, but so if you don't have a current appraised value, given all the conditions, I would think the appraisal would kind of take into consideration these buildings on the land and all that kind of stuff. So how then do you decide? So you're making a decision about what the fair value is or what you can get for it without the assistance of a current appraisal. Am I understanding that correctly? How are you making that decision then of what price you should get for it? Because surely we don't want to give it away for less than we could be getting for it.
Ms. Lewis?
Mr. Chair, members, the appraisal did take into account of the buildings and the state of the buildings. So we have an appraisal that does say this is what it's worth. Obviously, in the marketplace, we don't have anybody coming forth saying we'll pay you that. And so you do have that dichotomy that you're recognizing, that there's appraiser saying it's worth this much, the market's not willing to come forth and pay that much. And so that's what we're trying to address with the legislation, to not go back and pay for another appraisal and say, give me a liquidation value. We're saying, let's be able to go for less than the appraised value. The state did pay $200,000 to get this property back from Wilder Foundation. So we have kind of a base level that we don't want to go below two for our process.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, question I have, is there a potential buyer that has expressed an interest at a price below the appraised value? Is there somebody that's attempting to negotiate that property if it were to be on the market for less?
Ms. Lewis?
Mr. Chair, we do have two or three inquiries in the last few months of parties who have looked at the property and have talked about offering us a number that's less than appraised value. We are not in negotiations with them at this point. What we would do with this property, we would first offer it through the public offering to see which, you know, the best number we can obtain on this property. But we do have some parties who said, I am willing to buy it maybe if you lower the price.
Yeah, and
Representative Carlson.
So, being that we're dealing with public lands, when you advertise that, do you advertise a potential price then, or just how does that work when you're soliciting more formal offers? I specifically said they had expressed an interest, so I assumed that they hadn't made an offer yet. But how do you begin that process when we change it from an appraised value to something else?
Ms. Lewis?
Mr. Chair, members, the standard process is we have a value for our sales that are offered and parties bid at that amount or above. So this is not the normal practice. So, but what we would do in this case is we would have a public auction. We could either do it by sealed bid, or we could do it by public auction, and that leads up by people bidding orally. And so we could either do both of those practices. Standard practices you would put forth is that you would say we're offering it, and you could set a threshold, or we could just say, here's 296 is what we're asking, who's willing to offer, and try working your way down. But we want to start, you know, at the higher level and work our way down, not start at a low level and work our way up.
Okay, thank you.
Carlson. Other questions, anyone? Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Lewis, Representative Dill, is there any of the four bills that have to do with Lake or St. Louis County that are in District 3B?
Ms. Lewis or Chair Dill?
Mr. Chairman, I do not believe so. The bills in Lake County are outside of the city of Two Harbors, which you would represent.
Good. And there is no public land from in St. Louis County that's being turned into private land.
Your Hill?
I do not believe so, and I will check with Mr. Angaro on that to absolutely be sure. Ms. Lewis is telling me no.
Thank you.
Chair Dill, this might be a bit of a stumper of a question, but do you have any idea how many total acres are being sold or conveyed in House File 1429?
I do not, Mr. Chairman.
I mean, I know there's quite a number of separate parcels, and I guess a person could look through and see how much is in each parcel, and I guess I haven't done that either, but I was just curious if we had a total number.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that's a good question, and I will be prepared to answer that question if I am asked that on the House floor.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions?
Yeah.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dill, just as I'm looking through the bill here, the most of this I'm seeing is tax forfeited land.
Mm-hmm.
There's a private sale of surplus state land in Todd County. And sorry if I missed this before, but and I was looking on your list here to see whose bill this was, and I don't see one for Todd County on the, oh, I'm sorry, that wasn't your list. It's the House Research Summary. Doesn't have, I just wondered where, which one, what that one, if you could just tell us again what that one is.
Sure, Dale.
Mr. Chairman, I think I'll have Ms. Lewis answer that question.
Ms. Lewis.
Mr. Chair, House File 1429 started as the DNR bill, so there are three parcels in the bill, the CASP parcel, the Pine County parcel, and the Todd County parcel. And Representative Deal was the author of House File 1429 in its original stage before it morphed into this combination of bills.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, could you just tell us again real briefly what that one is, though?
Ms. Lewis.
Why is that surplus land?
Certainly. This is a 0.36-acre parcel of land along the Long Prairie River in Todd County. It is a parcel of land that the state acquired through the Department of Rural Credit back in the 1930s. That was a program to help out agricultural industry and the farming community, and they went into a mortgage business. The state went into a mortgage business, and a lot of those mortgages ended up being foreclosed due to the Depression and the agricultural industry. And what happened is the Department of Rural Credit subsequently sold parcels, and there was a 0.36-acre parcel sold to the Department of Conservation for the purposes of an earthen dike. The earthen dike was put up. It has been removed decades ago. The department's not managing the 0.36 acres, and the adjacent landowner says, I would like that piece of property, and we're quite happy to sell that to him.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Hackbarth.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I just wanted to thank Ms. Lewis and Representative Dill for doing a great job on this bill. We try to keep the Department Lands Bill non-controversial, and we've done that in this bill. And thank you for chairing the committee, Representative Dill, and doing a great job on the bill. And thank you, Ms. Lewis.
See no further discussion. Representative McNamara renews his motion that House File 1429, as amended, be referred to the General Register. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. House File 1429 is, as amended, is referred to the General Register. Next bill, also with Representative Dill, is House File 815. The chair will move that House File 815 be referred to the General Register. And Representative Dill, there is an amendment, the A2 amendment, that is being passed out. I don't believe this amendment was posted, but I will waive the 24-hour rule, and I will move the A2 amendment. And Representative Dill, if you, I guess, want to describe, I don't know if you want to describe House File 815 first and then take up the A2 amendment. Would that be your preference?
Whatever the chair would like. I think that it, probably to get the bill perfectly ready to discuss, let's adopt the amendment first, if that's okay with you.
Well, why don't you explain the amendment, Representative Dill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If you look on page 2 of the bill that's before us, you will see on line 2.17 the wording that we are changing, and it's a reshuffling of the wording. It does, in my estimation, I'm okay with it either way. But Minnesota Association of Counties came in and asked that it be restructured slightly to make it more clear.
Thank you.
And so I brought that amendment before you. I don't see anyone here in the audience that is ready to testify on that. I think that it does the same thing either way, but they were more comfortable with it the way that it's presented in the amendment. So I brought it forward for your consideration.
Seems like a fairly technical amendment. Any discussion to the A2 amendment? Seen none. Oh, Representative Kahn.
Could we have an explanation of the whole Section 3, what that does? That must be somewhere in my information that I just haven't paid attention to.
Representative Dill, can you explain Section 3?
Yes, and Section 3, as unamended, is what the situation is this. The biofuel industry is expanding, where we're using agricultural products and things of that nature to fire furnaces for a variety of different things, for electricity, for making of taconite pellets. In fact, U.S. Steel was issued a permit by the PCA to use biofuels to reduce their emissions. And what has happened is they're reaching out. The companies that provide this biofuel are reaching out all over the Midwest to get biofuels to do this. And one of the things that has occurred is that in the hauling of oat hulls, this is not the oat that you have inside that makes the cereal over at General Mills. This is the residue around it. The statute was unclear as to whether or not they could haul oat and the hull together at the highest weight, but they can't haul just the hull for biofuel. And so what was happening was that there are a few people that are hauling oat hulls for biofuels and all of a sudden realized that this was a technical issue in the language. So what we've come before you is to fix that, and we very narrowly drafted this so that it's not for any other purposes other than biofuel only. And so you would be able to haul residue of different sorts, but specifically oat hulls. And I can tell you that oat hulls must have a really good presence in a furnace to make a lot of heat to produce the desired effect, because they're being hauled, and they're being hauled from Canada and from anywhere where there's oats being produced. And it takes a pretty, it takes a lot of them to make 90,000 pounds or whatever the actual weight is on the 6 or 7 axles. That's the purpose of the bill. It came to me from Nagurski Trucking in International Falls, who is a big hauler of oat hulls and residue of agricultural products to biofuel facilities that burn it for energy. That's the purpose of the amendment. It originated in my legislative district in International Falls.
Representative Kahn?
Well, I guess the problem with every time we expand the weight limits for any reason is that it's further deterioration of our roads, which we apparently are having problems funding this year. So I wondered if there's some possibility of requiring for someone who's going to be hauling overweight, maybe anything, I don't remember paying attention to this before, paying an extra charge to do that would compensate for the damage to the roads. But if we're putting a new one on, and this looks like a pretty profitable industry, apparently, maybe we should certainly start by putting it on this one. I wondered if anyone's thought about this or talked about it.
Let's see. I've got Representative Hornstein, Albright, and Wagenius. Any comments from anyone? Otherwise, I'll go to Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Similar concerns as Representative Kahn. I just had a question for the author. You know, we have a few bills related to truck weights that are still in the Transportation Committee. Representative McNamara has one on porta potties. I don't have a big problem with that one. And he has a more expansive one with other agricultural products. But I guess I'm interested to know, Representative Dill, do we have a sense of how many trucks we're dealing with? You know, the first one that I had referenced with Representative McNamara, it seemed like a small number. I asked in committee, are we really dealing with a lot of trucks in that first instance with the porta potties? And there weren't a lot. There's many more with his second one. Do you have a sense of the volume that we're talking about here? Because that would make a difference, I think.
Representative Dill.
And Mr. Chairman, the exact number, of course, you could never predict. It could grow. Maybe other industries would like to use this for the same purpose, but in terms of the people who are hauling them now that I am aware of, it's a small number of trucks. I mean, the base number of trucks is less than 25.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. And I should maybe direct people to the fiscal note. I have some language on this issue underneath assumptions. I just quote, it says, though impossible to know, it appears there may be only a few additional overweight vehicles to be permitted. MnDOT estimates it will be minimal, and so will assume no additional revenue or cost. Representative Wagenius.
I just question the assumption of the fiscal note here, because we are on record as a state of wanting to expand biofuels. There are bills traveling through this legislature as we speak, subsidizing further the use of biofuels. I don't know whether MnDOT was aware of that when this fiscal note was written. So, and there are clearly plants using biofuels right over the border in Iowa. And it does appear that a lot of our residue will be going to Iowa for the plants for Iowa. So this is obviously an expanding area, so I come back to the original question of what's it cost to the rest of the taxpayers when our roads deteriorate and we don't have the current funding to pay for those roads. This seems premature to me to be considering this bill when we haven't seen some of the other energy bills.
I have Representative McNamara and Hamilton. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Representative Kahn's point, Representative Dill, it's current law, but on page 1, line 19, the fee is $300. So any of the trucks that want to get this permit not only pay the normal license fees for big trucks, but pay an additional fee of $300. And if I remember right, that's all goes into the bridge inspection fund at MnDOT. So they do pay for that, and this actually requires them to have additional axles so that the weight's actually better distributed and more braking capacity. And the MnDOT study actually says that whether there's cost and benefits to both doing this and not doing this, that they actually say the it makes the, a little bit better safety because of the additional braking capacity. So it's a good bill. Appreciate your support.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I think, you know, the way it is, if you haul the whole thing, it's okay. If you haul a portion of it, it is not. And that's where it just, it seems like common sense to us. It's almost you don't understand why we even need to be here, but it's interpreted differently. Like I said, right now, if we haul the entire thing, we're okay. But if we haul just a portion of it, we're not. And so it's clarifying, basically.
Representative Erdahl, then Liebling. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think it's a fine and needed piece of legislation, and we should vote for it.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I got the part about the oat hulls, and I would agree with Representative Hamilton, except that that's not what the bill says. It's including but not limited to oat hulls. And actually, I think that we're actually on the amendment, which I think is fine. I don't see any problem with the amendment. I agree with Representative Dill. I don't think it changes anything. But what the bill does is add, it's more than oat hulls. It's anything that might be transported for use as a biofuel, and I don't know how much might be in that category that isn't already in the raw or unprocessed agricultural products. I think that's kind of the issue, right? And so I started out a little more concerned than I am right now because I'm realizing that the bill's pretty limited, but I do want to maybe get some other assurances from Representative Dill if I can, because my area of the state, I've gotten quite a few communications from my county over all these different truck weight bills. And I realize that you're not actually increasing truck weights here, but you are increasing potentially volume of traffic. And I don't know how much of that would be going through my region. And just to be clear, it's not really about my district, which is urban. But our county is quite vulnerable with our bridges. And I've rarely seen an issue where my county commissioners have all written to me, and I have a letter in my hand from the sheriff of Olmsted County, really concerned. And one of the things he says, in Olmsted County, 16 of our local bridges are rated as being structurally deficient. And that's pretty clear that in our whole region, because of our topography, we have lots of bridges. They're local bridges. A lot of them are in trouble already. And these heavier truck weights are just very concerning for the county. So, Representative Dill, I mean, I know you said it's kind of hard to tell, but can you give me any sense? I mean, I'm not a person who knows a lot about agriculture. I'll tell you that right now. I mean, maybe I know a lot of you on the committee know a lot more than I do, but I really need some assurance that this isn't going to increase by very much the volume of heavy trucks going through my area, our region, not my district, but the southeast corner of the state where we've got this really critical infrastructure problem. So could you address that for me, Representative Dill?
Say, Representative Dill, before you do that, I think it seems like we're really getting into a discussion of the bill here, and I'm not really hearing a lot of concern about the amendment. So perhaps we can just act on the amendment, unless someone has some other concerns on the amendment. I guess I'd renew my motion that we adopt the A2 amendment. All in favor of the A2 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The A2 amendment is adopted. Representative Dill, to the question of Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling. I mean, the bill specifically narrows it down to agricultural products, and certainly that is something that is used for creating cleaner energy, which we're all supporting. I don't know the number of vehicles that may drive through your region, but the entire state has the same similar issues. The county, with regard to roads and bridges, there is a fee for doing this. It does not allow them to avoid buying an agricultural plate or a forest products plate if they're hauling those products. They still have to buy the same plate. There's a surcharge on this for the extra axles. And I don't know how that we are going to be able to feed our industry of biofuels, but what we can haul and make it so that it works out at the end consumer, the price of the electricity that's generated from this, or the energy that's generated. The county came before the committee originally, and of course the counties, the AMC said, we are against that's our unilateral position, we're against absolutely every single bill that would increase any truck weight on any highway, because they would have to post the highways of the higher weight. But that doesn't resonate with me, because they already have to post the highways and bridges for the higher weights, because there are already higher weights being hauled. So what we're really talking about is the additional number of trucks. The townships, I don't believe you will find anybody in this hearing today, I don't think, that is from the Association of Minnesota Counties or the township to testify for or against the bill. I cannot tell you, again, I will repeat, I cannot tell you how many trucks this is going to be. My sense is that it could grow in the future as we move towards more biofuels, or we're shipping biofuels out. The oat haul business specifically is coming into the state, not going out of the state. That's the best answer I have for you, Representative Liebling.
Okay. And
Representative Liebling.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Dill. And I'm starting to get some appreciation of sort of the difficulty of this issue, and sort of there are a lot of, I mean, you certainly give a lot of good reasons why we need to do the transportation. There's no question about it. And probably where we really will come down on this is that we just need to up our infrastructure to be able to accommodate the needs of our state. It seems to be the bottom line here. But I just wanted to ask you about this issue, too, that my sheriff included in his letter. He says that because there's an 80,000-pound limit on the interstate highway system, that means that these overweight trucks are shifted onto state and local roads. And I guess that, if that's true, and again, I wouldn't know it if I didn't read it in his letter, but that's something that makes the problem a little bit more acute. Because of that, they're going onto these local roads, and I just have a great deal of difficulty right now, given how, you know, this will be alleviated, I think, in a lot of minds if this legislature is able to put serious money toward helping our local governments with these bridges, because I think in my area we just have disasters waiting to happen, and we're just tempting fate, I think, by increasing the truck traffic right now. Thank you.
Other questions for Representative Dill? Representative Dill, any last comments on the bill?
I just want to state that I am very fully aware of the issue of the 80,000-pound limit on the interstate. And let me give you an example of how that's affecting Representative Cinderbach's district and Representative Murphy's district. If you're cutting trees, for example, in Lake and Cook County, and you're bringing them down to Sappy or New Page or any of the mills that are just to the west of Duluth, they come down Highway 61, which is a state interregional corridor trunk highway, and then they can get on Interstate 35 and travel about 5 miles and be at the mill. But because they can haul at the higher weight, as you suggested, into the city of Duluth, and then there's this little spur, and if you've been to Duluth, you've seen how the interstate goes right around and comes out on the North Shore Highway, and that's what we're talking about. So every single pulp truck, every single lumber truck, every single truck that is hauling on a higher weight during the appropriate times, goes right down the center, past the jewelry store, past Minnesota Power's office, right through the center of Duluth. And we have worked, even when Chairman Oberstar was the chair of the Transportation Committee for the United States, we could not get relief. So still to this day, every single truck drives right past the jewelry store downtown Duluth, right by Essentia Health, through the center of Duluth. I mean, so I agree with you. We need to make some changes, but that has not happened. And I agree with you that we have to include further funding and increase and enhance our transportation network so that we can meet the needs of our state. So we're in total agreement on that. How we get there might not be so agreeable, but regarding this bill, it's needed.
Seeing no further discussion, the chair will renew his motion that House File 815, as amended, be referred to the General Register. All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
No.
Motion prevails. House File 815, as amended, is referred to the General Register. Thank you, Representative Dill.
Thank you very much.
Next on the agenda is Representative Runbeck with House File 631.
Morning, Mr. Chair.
Representative Runbeck, welcome to the Committee on Ways and Means. The Chair will move that House File 631 be referred to the General Register.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can give you a brief description. It's a fairly straightforward bill. It came from a constituent who had bought her license tabs in early July, decided in late July to sell her car, and the dealer said, well, no problem. You can probably get that refunded, your tabs refunded at the DVS office. Turned out later that she'd learned that they themselves, the dealer, had actually bought duplicate tabs, which that's another issue, actually, but two tabs had been issued for the same car. But she proceeded to go to the DVS office to get the refund and learned that they can't issue the refund at the office, and was given a form to mail in, which she did. A month later, got the letter back, or got a reply back, saying that she would have had to have requested the refund by August 1st to have been able to get a refund. So this is simply saying that we need to give a little bit of leeway for folks, and by putting the date for a deadline at a refund, rather, at the 10th of the month, after which the tab should have been on the car, you give the persons at least a little bit of grace period by which, if they've sold a car or moved out of the state or what have you, they're able to get a refund. So, and apparently she's not the only person that this happens to. So that's the, if you take a look at the fiscal note, I guess the department, you know, has estimated that there are, what is it, 400 folks maybe that, you know, might apply for a refund. But I have worked with Pat McCormick at the office. they have also said that their form for a refund will state, you know, what the rules are and let people know that there is a deadline by which they have to apply.
Yes, Representative Runbeck. The fiscal note says that the DVS receives 480 applications for refund each month. Questions for Representative Runbeck for discussion on the bill?
Mr. Chair, I might also say that August 10th, maybe I said this already, but the 10th of the month is the date by which the law states folks have to have their tabs affixed to their car. So it lines that up, I think, nicely.
Okay. Well, seeing no discussion, the chair renews his motion that House File 631 be referred to the General Register. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. House File 631 is referred to the General Register. Thank you, Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Committee.
Last bill on the calendar, Representative Zerwas, House File 1164. The chair will move that House File 1164 be referred to the General Register. Representative Zerwas, welcome to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Well, good morning, Mr. Chairman, members. First timer at the Ways and Means, so thank you for having me.
For the cookies. Oh.
I think I've dispensed enough treats for everyone. members, House File 1164 deals with third-party testing for school bus driver's license. The state of Minnesota, through administrative rule, allows for third-party testing for commercial driver's license, including school bus endorsements currently. A third-party testing program allows for school bus contractors and school bus and school districts to administer road and skills tests to applicants for CDL. In fact, some states like Wisconsin and South Dakota utilize only third-party testers. Wisconsin and South Dakota do not even administer road or skill tests for commercial driver's license applicants. House File 1164 proposes to codify three main components of administrative rules regarding eligibility qualifications and test administration of the current third-party testing system. Some requirements under Minnesota Rule 7410 are not reflected in this House file, as the Minnesota school bus operators desire to ease some of the restrictions around third-party testing. This bill does not propose to incorporate the 50-employee minimum in order to qualify to be a third-party tester. 50 or more employees that would be candidates for testing, as the current rule allows, would be removed. House File 1164 proposes to allow school bus contractors to test other school bus companies to allow some cooperation, as it's currently allowed for school districts to test other school districts. And we would allow a fee for the school bus company to assess a fee for that training. Another component of the existing rule not being proposed is a requirement to perform 12 road or skill tests per year. There are 68 third-party testing programs in Minnesota. Two are school districts, according to the department. The Minnesota School Bus Operators Association is looking for ways to shorten the time frame to apply for and receive a commercial driver's license with that S or school board or school bus endorsement. The school bus driver shortage in Minnesota is one of the things we're trying to address here. And as we've gotten out and talked to owners and operators of school bus companies and school districts, we're really seeing, especially in greater Minnesota, a significant shortage of school bus drivers, where literally every single day throughout the school year, you're going to have an owner-operator driving routes him or herself in order to make ends meet. We have examples in greater Minnesota where school districts have actually canceled school for the day because they couldn't get enough school bus drivers to get the students to class. This is certainly a shortage, and especially during the busy season of late July and August, we had significant wait times for the testing procedures last year, and so we're just trying to help these school bus companies out.
Discussion to the bill. Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, it's my understanding that Department of Motor Vehicle Services, or DVS, has some concerns about it, and you've referenced school bus drivers, but the bill, as I read the summary here and look at the bill, it appears to be broader than that. And I think in your testimony you referenced motorcycles and what have you. So just how broad is the bill beyond school bus drivers, I guess, is my first question, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Representative Zerwas, are you a testifier, sir? Mr. Keller, can you give us your name for your record and your testimony?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. Good morning, members of the committee, Mr. Chair. My name is Tom Kelleher. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota School Bus Operators Association. We are the private bus contractors that do contracting relationships with the school districts. We are about one half of the 18,000 yellow school buses in the state driving around. To answer Representative Carlson's question, the bill is designed to only affect school bus companies, school bus operators. We are copying what we think are some of the better features of an existing third-party testing program at Driver and Vehicle Services. And that while there is references to commercial driver's licenses and motor carriers and motorcycle safety courses, those are exact copies of the existing rule. The council and the other body thought that it was important to put those definitions in for the codification of what's before you in House File 1164, and that basically all those features are in existing Minnesota Rule 7410. I hope that answers your question.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, so one advantage of being on this committee is this committee, you learn a lot. I didn't realize that. So third-party testers can be used for commercial and motorcycles?
Yes, sir.
Is that what I heard?
Mr.
Kelleher.
And Representative Carlson, I didn't make copies for the committee, but this is Wisconsin's six-page list of their commercial driver's license third-party testers. They do commercial driver's license exams for A, B, and C class licenses and school buses, and in some cases they even provide a vehicle as a private contractor for the person to test in. As I said in South, as Representative Zerwas said, in South Dakota and Wisconsin, it's the only way to get a commercial driver's license is through a third-party tester. In Minnesota, we have both systems. We have the state providing testing systems for both the written, the basic controls, and the skills test and the road test. So we don't believe we're reinventing the wheel. We're just trying to make it so that some of our providers, some of our contractors, they may be interested in becoming a third-party tester. And while the fiscal note talks about doubling the size of the program from 68 to what would be over 130, from the conversations we've had within our own industry, and we believe we're the predominant interested third-party testing folks, that we think less than a dozen of our people would apply, not double from 68 to whatever that would be, 136 or something.
Representative Carlson. Mr. Chairman, I wish we had maybe an opportunity to learn more about what DVS's concerns are.
Representative Carlson, there is perhaps a representative from DVS here. If there is someone that wants to, we certainly welcome there or anyone else's testimony.
Yeah. And Mr. Chairman, just so you're aware, I'm coming at it from back years ago when I chaired the Education Committee, one of our big issues was school bus safety. And we worked extensively with the State Highway Patrol and others to enhance school bus safety. And that's where my concern is coming at it from, wanting to make sure that we're not somehow creating a situation where we would have drivers that would be not fully trained. In fact, I think even when I look over at Mr. Marks, probably was staffing that committee at that particular point in time, probably remembers some of the issues better than I. But that's one of the reasons we have the arms and all the different things that are on the buses today as a result of some of that work. And in fact, I think we spent a couple of biennium working, or a couple of years within a biennium working on that very issue in the Education Committee, and also heard from your association at the time. I don't know if it was you personally or not, but that's where I'm coming at it from. I want to make sure that we're not somehow creating or increasing risk factors for our young people that are loaded into those buses. So I appreciate your allowing the department to respond to the question.
Sure. Can I have the representative of the department introduce herself?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Pat McCormick, the Director of Driver and Vehicle Services with the Department of Public Safety. And the, as was stated, the department does have some concerns with this legislation. We have third-party testing programs that have been in place, and they are we have rules that are required to be administered that eliminate the need for agreements with each testing program and provide the force and effect of law to the program. Currently, we have 53 approved CDL testing programs, which are primarily school bus companies, public transit entities, motor carriers, and MNSCU truck driving programs. The individual testers must be employees of the testing program, and there are 69 third-party testers for these programs. There is no exchange of money that's allowed with this this program, and that is one of the concerns that we have. There have been problems in various states throughout the country where there have been money changing hands in terms of fraud. Several states have not been allowed to continue their testing programs as a result. And so that was one of the concerns that we have discussed. Those were there were states, Utah, Michigan, Missouri, and Tennessee, that were not allowed to do the testing, and they had been required to retake the programs. And a lot of those testers, with the people that were wanting to be retested, have come to Minnesota because of the fact that they can't get licenses in other states. So that's why we're aware of this incident. We've also been talking with the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration regarding it, and they have approved of our program since they regulate it at the federal level. If for some reason we would not pass the federal level, then we would not be allowed to issue those driver's licenses, and that's what's happened in these other states. The federal law also would have the ability also to withhold federal funds if we were in we were not in compliance with federal regulations. Those are our concerns, but our major concern is that we want to make sure that we have drivers that are following the law and complying with the law, especially when you're talking about school bus children, the children that are taking school buses on a daily basis to get to school.
Mr. Kelleher or Representative Zerwas?
Mr. Chairman, just briefly, as the representative from DVS stated, we already do third-party testing. Right now it's in Minnesota rule. We're proposing to codify it with a few minor changes. One of those is saying that you don't have to have 50 employees. We have some school bus companies that would like to do testing that have fewer than 50 employees. I don't think that would make anything more unsafe. One of it is, if one school bus operating company wants to work out a contractual agreement to test another school bus operating company's employees, allow one company to test another company's potential employees, we would allow that. Under current rules, school districts can test a different school district's employees. We're saying a school bus company should be able to test another school bus company's employees. And we're saying for up to $50 per employee, or pardon me, up to $100 per employee. The impetus behind this, members, is this last fall, if you saw a now hiring $15 an hour come drive a school bus, and you saw that in July or August, and you said, I want to drive a school bus, the Department of Vehicle Services this fall at the start of school could get you tested and get you approved and get you through and get you licensed by October or November. It was a 90-day wait this fall. That's not acceptable. This program already exists. We're looking for ways to make it easier and help out more companies test other companies' employees. That's what this bill does. And the idea that independent third-party testing school bus companies would double because of changing these limitations is not what industry says will happen, and is not realistic, and therefore the fiscal note is out of line with what will happen.
Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, maybe you've touched on it. I know one of the justifications for the bill seems to be the shortage of school bus drivers. I know I go up Winnetka Avenue close to where I live, and I go past the Robbinsdale School District, and they had signs up, bus drivers wanted, may still be there. After a while, a sign is out of your mindset, I guess. But I still have concern about the safety, and I guess I'd like DVS to respond to the question then of the 90-day comment by the author as to why that's happening and what DVS would need to do to correct that, because my bottom line is still the safety question and my long history years ago dealing with school bus safety.
Okay, Ms. McCormick, and then I'll recognize Mr. Kelleher. Ms. McCormick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I certainly, I'm not aware of this issue with the exact issue that's being talked about. Certainly, we have been working very hard to try to address getting as many tests as we are able to, but we have always made it a priority, especially at that time of year with school bus, making sure that the school bus tests are taking place. I agree that we have to address any issues where we're talking about not having enough drivers, and certainly we have already asked to speak with the author and the representative here to talk about this legislation, and we have never had a meeting. And so I am dealing with the legislation as it is. We are making, as all of you know, because of legislation you passed last year, we are addressing our exam testing process, and we are adding additional hours so that we can do as be as timely as possible with giving the tests that are needed for people so that they can drive. And we certainly respect the fact that people need to have these licenses so that they can work. But I do not believe that that changing the program the way it is outlined here would really make that difference. And I don't think that the department would approves of the this exchange of dollars as well in this case, because I would be concerned with Federal Motor Carrier Safety's administration's issue with that particular part of the bill. So those are some of the concerns, and I'm glad to answer any other questions.
Let's see. I wanted to recognize Mr. Kelleher, too, and then I'll go back to you, Representative Carlson.
Fine. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is in somewhat response to Representative Carlson's comments as well as regards to safety. We're not changing any of the requirements of what is a passing grade for a test or what is the requirements to understand, learn, in regards to the road test, the understanding of the written test, passage of the written test, or what they call a skills test. We have to walk around the bus and point to different features, mechanical features, the brakes, the bus, the engines, the wipers, all that sort of stuff. We're not changing any of the criteria for that. We're not changing the third-party testing system as it exists. The department has the authority, and does, under federal law, audit all third-party testers. The department has the right to come in and retest any licensees that they feel were inappropriately or inappropriately tested, and there might have been some impropriety, which I don't think there's a great deal of those sorts of things. I've heard, and with the department, and we've had three meetings with the department, so I want to make that clear, that the department has only disallowed or took away a third-party tester's credentials in one instance that I'm aware of. In regards to the fraud in these couple of other states, we're not interested in having people buy licenses. We have safety issues every day at schools. We're very careful and very cautious and very cognizant of the fact that we're transporting school students. We make it abundantly clear to our drivers that we don't tolerate any sorts of drug abuse, alcohol abuse, substance abuses. There are all sorts of statutes and rules that require a very high standard of a personal background. in order to be a school bus driver, as much as the teacher, because of the packages they travel with. As I said, in regards to the fraud, you know, we're perfectly happy making it a felony, you know, if that's the concern. But it hasn't been happening in Minnesota to date. And I think the only reason that one person had their certification removed as a third-party tester is because over the paperwork or the way he was administering the tests. So that's sort of our story. We're not trying to change really that much of this existing program. We've had extreme driver shortages. They closed the Onamia School District once this year because they didn't have enough drivers. In southern Minnesota, our drivers did their regular routes and then did a contracted route for the school district down there because they didn't have enough drivers for the day. As Representative Sirwas sort of said earlier, that you know, at my board meetings with my members of the School Bus Operators Association, I ask how many people drove a bus this week. All these owners and managers say they raised their hand. How many drove today? They all do. They're all picking up shifts because we're so short of bus drivers. And the problem really occurs in the late summer, early fall. The department has showed me some detail now that says they're turning around this documentation in a very timely fashion. But we're 6 weeks to the end of school. Didn't help us a great deal in the summer and early fall when it was, there were a lot of 90-day delays.
Representative Carlson, yeah. I want to get to Representative Liebling, too. Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I expressed the concern I have. If the bill moves forward today, what I would like to request of DVS is some more information on that long wait period. Because, as I say, using my school district as an example, I know that they apparently have had some difficulty hiring bus drivers. Now, I don't know if testing was related to that at all. Did I just see the sign, bus drivers wanted, you know, out on Winnetka Avenue and in New Hope? So I don't know if there's a tie there or not, but perhaps DVS can get back to those of us that might be interested in the issue with information on what that timeline is, because I too would be concerned if it takes 90 days. I'd be friendly toward your position in that regard, but I still have to be honest and say I've got reservations because I worked very hard years ago on the school bus safety issue and want to make sure that we're not putting our children at risk when they're riding on a school bus. But thank you.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to follow up on the comment about the spot checks and or the potential for spot checks. And I want to ask Ms. McCormick if the department does or can do random kind of retests to quality check the testers. Is that something that happens or could be happening? Obviously, it would cost some money, but maybe there's a potential room for working together on that one.
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, we do some spot checks or what we call, I can't even think of the word for it, but what we do is we do those kinds of checks so that we're checking to see how the drivers are doing. That is a part of the system in terms of monitoring, and that is required in federal regulations that take place. I can't tell you offhand at how much we do that or what our criteria is, so I'll be glad to respond to the committee and let you know.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That would be helpful, and I'm just interested to know when you say you're checking, do you do a retest? Do you like randomly pick somebody and say, let me just retest you and make sure that you actually do meet the criteria? Or is it something else?
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, we do. I'm going to have to get back to you so that I put it in the correct terms. I'm not the expert on this, but yes, we do. We do have a way where we do some what we call covert monitoring. In other words, the one thing I can tell you that I know for sure we do is we have the schedule of all the third-party testers that we have for school bus companies. And we are regional and assistant regional supervisors do what we call covert monitoring, and that is required by Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration rules so that we follow the drivers and we follow the testing program to make sure that they're complying with what they have to do as part of the tests, because the tests are very much, there are several requirements that have to be met when they're administering tests. So we do that. I can get that part of the rule to explain it more to the committee. So,
Mr. Kelleher, Representative Zerwas, any other comments on the bill?
I'll just wrap it up. I think the important thing to get back to what we're actually changing, and that is there's already third-party testing. It's already being done. There's three changes to a current administrative rule we'd like to make, and that is taking away the employee, 50-employee limit where you need 50 employees before you can do a test, allowing school bus companies to test another school bus company, just like a school district can test another school district. That would be the second change. And then allowing for the $100 fee, a contractual agreement if one school bus company is providing a test for another school bus company. And fees for third-party testing are assessed in Wisconsin and South Dakota, and they don't have this rampant fraud and abuse. And as far as safety components go, there's an amount of third-party testing for school buses that already occurs. It's just it's only for the bigger school bus companies or districts that test other districts. We're just trying to allow a little bit more flexibility. And there hasn't been a concern to date with third-party tests as it regards to school bus safety and the safety of the drivers that they license.
All right. Well, Ms. McCormick, if you could provide the information that was requested by Representative Carlson and I think Representative Liebling to Craig Stone here, we'll get it distributed to the committee. And with that, if there are no other comments or questions, I'll renew my motion that House File 1164 be referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No.
Motion prevails. House File 1164 is referred to the General Register.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
Okay, members of the committee, we have our meeting at 10:15 on Monday morning. There being no other business to come before the committee today, the meeting is adjourned.